Disc 19. Hamilton was no less convinced of Jefferson's hidden aspirations. In the spring of 1792, he had written, "'Tis evident beyond a question, from every movement, that Mr. Jefferson aims with ardent desire at the presidential chair." When Hamilton's son John wrote his father's biography, he left out one story that is contained in his papers. The authenticity of the anecdote cannot be verified, but it jibes with other things Hamilton said. According to this story, soon after Jefferson announced his plans to step down, Washington and Hamilton were alone together when Jefferson passed by the window. Washington expressed regret at his departure, which he attributed to his desire to withdraw from public life and devote himself to literature and agriculture. Staring at Washington with a dubious smirk, Hamilton asked, "Do you believe, sir, that such is his only motive?" Washington saw that Hamilton was biting his tongue and urged him to speak. Hamilton explained that he had long entertained doubts about Jefferson's character, but as a colleague had restrained himself. Now he no longer felt bound by such scruples. Hamilton offered this prediction, as summarized by his son. From the very outset, Jefferson had been the instigation of all the abuse of the administration and of the president, that he was one of the most ambitious and intriguing men in the community, that retirement was not his motive, that he found himself from the state of affairs with France in a position in which he was compelled to assume a responsibility as to public measures which warred against the designs of his party, that for that cause he retired, that his intention was to wait events, then enter the field and run for the plate. That if future events did not prove the correctness of this view of his character, he, Hamilton, would forfeit all title to a knowledge of mankind. John C. Hamilton continued that in the late 1790s, Washington told Hamilton that not a day has elapsed since my retirement from public life in which I have not thought of that conversation. Every event has proved the truth of your view of his character. You foretold what has happened with the spirit of prophecy. The story's likely veracity is bolstered by the fact that Jefferson exchanged no letters with Washington during the last 3.5 years of the general's life. For Hamilton, the triumph over Jefferson was a bittersweet victory that he scarcely had time to savor. He was besieged by enemies, worried about his health, and felt unappreciated by the public. In a letter to Angelica Church, Hamilton, nearly 39, struck again a world-weary note. But how oddly are all things arranged in this sublunary scene. I am just where I do not wish to be. I know how I could be much happier, but circumstances enchain me. In another letter he said, "Believe me, I am heartily tired of my situation and wait only the opportunity of quitting it with honor and without decisive prejudice to the public affairs." The Republicans had captured majorities in the Congress that convened in December 1793, and that would render a final verdict over Hamilton's conduct as Treasury Secretary. He had already told Washington that he would stay in office only as long as it took to clear his name. In mid-December 1793, in a rare political spectacle, Hamilton asked House Speaker Muhlenberg to resume the Giles inquiry. While he had been exonerated by the first Giles investigation, the examination had been rushed by the short deadline, and Hamilton wanted to erase any last doubts about his probity. Whatever private melancholy he poured out to Angelica Church, he sounded buoyantly combative when he told Muhlenberg of the probe, "The more comprehensive it is, the more agreeable it will be to me." The Republicans were happy to oblige him. Even before Giles got down to business, Senator Albert Gallatin of Pennsylvania submitted resolutions asking for a comprehensive account of Treasury operations. He demanded reams of paper from Hamilton, ranging from a full statement of foreign and domestic debt to an itemized list of revenues. This oppressive investigation was scrapped when the foreign-born Gallatin lost his Senate seat after charges were made that he had not met the 9-year citizenship requirement. Hamilton, meanwhile, chafed at the dilatory tactics of Giles, who did not revive the Treasury inquiry until late February, even as Hamilton made threatening noises that he would resign. Hamilton was being badgered from all sides. He was still deluged with questionable petitions, often marred by fraud or missing paperwork from people claiming compensation for services provided during the Revolution. He felt so harassed by complaints of negligence from the Senate that on February 22nd he complained to Vice President Adams in an anguished letter. Hamilton alluded to burdensome petitions, the disruptions of the yellow fever epidemic, and eternal congressional studies of his conduct. As a conscientious public servant, he felt he should be spared petty censure over his handling of the petitions. I will only add that the conscientiousness of devoting myself to the public service, to the utmost extent of my faculties, and to the injury of my health, is a tranquilizing consolation of which I cannot be deprived by any supposition to the contrary. 9 days later, Hamilton delivered to Congress his decisions on no fewer than 30 complex petitions for wartime compensation. On February 24th, the House assembled a select committee with sweeping powers to investigate the Treasury Department. Reflecting the new composition of Congress, the bulk of the committee was Republican. The members drew up an exhausting schedule to drain any energy Hamilton had left. Until their work was complete, they planned to meet every Tuesday and Thursday evening and Saturday morning. For 3 months, the committee stuck to this punitive schedule, and Hamilton testified at about half the sessions. Besides providing extensive official information, he had to disclose all of his private accounts with the Bank of the United States and the Bank of New York, as Republicans tried to prove that Hamilton had exploited his office to extort credits from the two banks. The Select Committee, finding it hard to fix blame on Hamilton, fell back on the one charge that Giles had made stick, that he had exercised too much discretion in shifting government funds between the United States and Europe. When the committee asked Hamilton to cite his authority for transferring money abroad to the Bank of the United States, he cited both verbal authority and a letter from the president. The committee, suspecting a bluff, demanded proof, and Hamilton asked Washington for a letter to back up his assertions. Washington obliged Hamilton with a mealy-mouthed letter that was so bland. From my general recollection of the course of proceedings, I do not doubt that it was substantially as you have stated it, as to undercut Hamilton's position. His enemies guffawed. The letter from the president is inexpressibly mortifying to his, Hamilton's, friends, Madison wrote to Jefferson, and marks his situation to be precisely what you always described it to be. As delicately as possible, a crestfallen Hamilton advised Washington that his letter might seem a lukewarm endorsement to cynics. He worried that false and insidious men would use it to infuse doubts and distrusts very injurious to me. In fact, Washington was beginning to balk at Hamilton's requests to transfer money in ways not tightly tied to specific legislative acts. Whether he thought the Jeffersonian arguments had merit or merely popular backing, Washington subtly distanced himself from Hamilton, insisting that he segregate funds from different sources. Once again, he proved that he was not a rubber stamp for Hamilton's policies. At the same time, he hardly wished to repudiate his Treasury Secretary and promised to help out with Congress. In the end, the Select Committee found no wrongdoing in the way Hamilton had used European loans for domestic purposes. In its final report in late May, the Republican-dominated committee could not deliver the comeuppance it had craved. Instead, it confessed that all the charges lodged against Hamilton were completely baseless, as the Treasury Secretary had insisted all along. And what of the endless Jeffersonian insinuations that Hamilton had used public office to extract private credits? The report concluded that it appears that the Secretary of the Treasury never has, either directly or indirectly, for himself or any other person, procured any discount or credit from either of the said banks, Bank of New York and Bank of the United States, upon the basis of any public monies which, at any time, have been deposited therein under his direction. The vindication was so resounding that Hamilton withdrew his long-standing resignation, and his cabinet position grew more impregnable than ever. Nevertheless, it frustrated him that after this exhaustive investigation, his opponents still rehashed the stale charges of misconduct. He had learned a lesson about propaganda in politics and mused wearily that no character, however upright, is a match for constantly reiterated attacks, however false. If a charge was made often enough, people assumed in the end that a person so often accused cannot be entirely innocent. Once again, the best clue to Hamilton's mood comes from his confiding letters to Angelica Church, who still felt trapped in England by her husband's position in Parliament. In one letter, Hamilton offered Church a whimsical but rueful meditation on the nature of public office. This previously overlooked letter is contained in the papers of Hamilton's son James, who tore off and crossed out other portions, making one wonder whether it contained evidence of the long-rumored affair between Hamilton and his sister-in-law. Hamilton observed, "Truly, this trade of a statesman is but a sorry thing. It plagues a man more than enough, and when it obliges him to sacrifice his own pleasure, it is very far from fitting him the better to please other people. I speak from experience. You will ask why I do not quit this disagreeable trade. How can I? What is to become of my fame and glory? How will the world go on without me? I am sometimes told very gravely it could not, and one ought not, you know, to be very difficult of faith about what is much to our advantage. Besides, you would lose the pleasure of speaking of your brother-in-law as the Chancellor of the Exchequer if I am to give up the trade. There is no fear that the minister will spoil the man. I find by experience that the man is every day getting the upper hand of the minister." Chapter 25. Seas of Blood. After Jefferson left the cabinet, Washington did not conduct a purge of Republicans. On the contrary, the unity-minded president turned to the foremost congressional Republican, James Madison, as his first choice as Secretary of State. Only when Madison rejected the job did Washington hand it to Attorney General Edmund Randolph, who was succeeded in his post by William Bradford of Philadelphia. This sequence of events did not stop Jefferson and Madison from complaining that Washington was a captive of crafty, manipulative Federalists. Jefferson's presence lingered in Congress through Madison. On the eve of his departure, Jefferson submitted a bulky report to the House on European trade policies toward America. He laid out a litany of charges, from unfair dominance of transatlantic shipping to the banning of American boats from the British West Indies, to buttress his claim that England discriminated against American trade. Based on this evidence, Jefferson advocated commercial reprisals against Britain, coupled, not surprisingly, with expanded trade relations with France. On January 3, 1794, Madison introduced 7 congressional resolutions that converted Jefferson's brief into a tough anti-British trade policy. 10 days later, Federalist William Lawton Smith rebutted him in an eloquent speech of 15,000 words that adroitly picked apart Madison's arguments. Smith suggested that it would be suicidal for America to disrupt relations with a country that accounted for most of its trade. As soon as Jefferson scanned Smith's speech, he knew his old bête noire had struck again. "I am at no loss to ascribe Smith's speech to its true father," he told Madison. "Every letter of it is Hamilton's, except the introduction." Jefferson had guessed shrewdly. Hamilton either drafted Smith's speech or provided the information. Responding to Madison's attempts to solidify relations with France, Hamilton lashed back in his time-tested manner. Under the disguise of Americanus, he published 2 fervid newspaper essays about the horrors of the French Revolution. He condemned apologists for the horrid and disgusting scenes being enacted in France and branded Marat and Robespierre assassins still reeking with the blood of murdered fellow citizens. Long before Napoleon came on the scene, he predicted that after wading through seas of blood, France may find herself at length the slave of some victorious Caesar. Unfortunately for Hamilton, even as he touted England as a law-abiding ally, the British evinced a bullying arrogance and stupidity toward America that surpassed the most acrid Jeffersonian caricatures. England refused to acknowledge the traditional doctrine, "free ships make free goods," that is, that neutral vessels had a right to carry all cargo save munitions and enter the ports of belligerent countries. On November 6, 1793, William Pitt's ministry had decreed that British ships could intercept neutral vessels hauling produce to or from the French West Indies. Without further ado, the British fleet captured more than 250 American merchant ships, impounding more than half of them as war prizes. Britain also boarded American vessels at sea and dragged off sailors, claiming they were British seamen who had deserted. These high-handed actions kicked up such a ruckus in America that for the first time since the Revolution, the prospect of a new war against Great Britain seemed a genuine possibility. The Federalists felt shocked, betrayed, and embittered. "The English are absolute madmen," sputtered an indignant Fisher Ames. "Order in this country is endangered by their hostility no less than by French friendship." When Hamilton heard about British depredations, he did not behave like a pawn of British interests. Rather, he drew up for Washington contingency plans to raise a 20,000-man army to defend coastal cities and impose a partial trade embargo. "The pains taken to preserve peace," he told Washington, "include a proportional responsibility that equal pains be taken to be prepared for war." Once again, Hamilton and Washington agreed that the executive branch should take the lead in a national emergency. While continuing to meet with his dogged congressional investigators, the sorely taxed Treasury Secretary instructed customs collectors to fortify ports for a possible invasion, while Federalists presented plans to Congress for a provisional army. As word spread that the omnipresent Hamilton might supervise this new force, Republicans discerned another insidious power play. "You will understand the game behind the curtain too well not to perceive the old trick of turning every contingency into a resource for accumulating force in the government," Madison told Jefferson. Madison and other Republicans opposed Federalist plans to form an army and increase taxes for national defense. When Federalists suggested that it was high time America had its own navy to combat the plunder of American shipping by Barbary pirates, Madison suggested, in all seriousness, that the United States hire the Portuguese Navy instead. Bent upon postponing war with Britain, influential Federalists gathered at the lodgings of Senator Rufus King. They agreed that Washington should send a special envoy to England and proposed Hamilton, who thought he was a splendid choice. As usual, the mere mention of his name sent Federalists into shivers of ecstasy. "Who but Hamilton would perfectly satisfy all our wishes?" asked Ames. At first, Washington leaned toward Hamilton and grew resentful when Edmund Randolph interposed objections. Randolph thought Hamilton had been too vocal in criticizing France to enjoy credibility as an objective negotiator with Britain. Republicans joined this chorus of dissent and talked as if Washington were about to deputize the devil himself. Representative John Nicholas, brother-in-law of Senator James Monroe, told the president, apropos of Hamilton, that more than half of America have determined it to be unsafe to trust power in the hands of this person. "Did it never occur to you that the divisions of America might be ended by the sacrifice of this one man?" Jefferson detected yet another cabal to place the aristocracy of this country under the patronage of the British government, not to mention a convenient way to send Hamilton abroad and protect him from the disgrace and public execrations which sooner or later must fall on the man. In the end, Washington concluded that Hamilton lacked the general confidence of the country and wisely opted for a less partisan figure. On April 14th, Hamilton composed a long, plaintive letter to Washington and removed himself from consideration for the post. Madison said that Hamilton was crushed and informed Jefferson that he had been turned down to his great mortification. Yet Hamilton must have known he would be a divisive choice. He also had reasons for staying close to home. He feared that without him, Washington might submit to Republican influence. He was still committed to vindicating his reputation before the Congressional Investigating Committee, and he wanted to deal with ominous protests now gathering force in western Pennsylvania against the excise tax he had imposed on liquor. In his letter to Washington, Hamilton made some statements on foreign policy of lasting significance, especially the idea of war as a last resort. He said that he belonged to the camp that wanted to preserve peace at all costs, consistent with national honor, resorting to war only if attempts at reparations failed. He warned that Republicans wanted to poison relations with Britain, foster amity with France, and cancel debts owed to England. The British would then retaliate by blocking commodity exports to America, causing a catastrophic drop in customs duties. This would bring the Treasury to an absolute stoppage of payment, an event which would cut up credit by the roots. Hamilton has often been extolled as the exponent of a rational foreign policy, based on cool calculations of national self-interest. But his April 14th letter expressed his unswerving conviction that nations, transported by strong emotion, often miscalculate their interests. "Wars oftener proceed from angry and perverse passions than from cool calculations of interest. War with Britain might unleash violent popular fantasies and set in motion turbulent passions that would lead to extremism on the French model, pushing America to the threshold of disorganization and anarchy. Like so many Hamilton polemics, the letter was a hot-blooded defense of a cool-eyed policy. When he took himself out of the running for envoy, Hamilton recommended John Jay as the perfect substitute. The only man in whose qualifications for success there would be thorough confidence, and him whom alone it would be advisable to send. As the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Jay lacked Hamilton's conspicuous liabilities as a party head. Hamilton had always admired Jay, but with reservations. He once said of Jay that he was a man of profound sagacity and pure integrity, yet he was of a suspicious temper. In contrast to Hamilton's colorful exuberance, Jay often dressed in black, tended to be taciturn, and could be aloof, though Philip Schuyler once said that he numbered Jay among the few men for whom he had an affection approaching love. Jay consented to undertake the mission to England without resigning as Chief Justice. Republicans found him more palatable than Hamilton, but far from a neutral choice. In their eyes, he was another Federalist smitten with England. Nevertheless, the Senate approved him. To offset Jay's appointment, Washington decided to choose a Republican to succeed Governor Morris as American minister to France and settled on James Monroe. Aaron Burr and some Republican colleagues suspected that Hamilton had induced Washington to veto Burr. For Burr, this was another of many times that Hamilton spiked his aspirations for office. But Washington continued to distrust Burr as a devious, prodigal man and needed no prodding from Hamilton. If Hamilton could not go to London, he would engage in freelance diplomacy at home. Even before Jay was confirmed by the Senate, Hamilton met twice with the imperious George Hammond, Britain's minister to the United States. Once again, those who saw Hamilton as toadying to Britain would have been surprised by how vehemently he laced into Hammond. Hammond told superiors back in London that the Treasury Secretary entered into a pretty copious recital of the injuries which the commerce of this country had suffered from British cruisers, and into a defense of the consequent claim which the American citizens had on their government to vindicate their rights. Hamilton wanted compensation for American vessels captured in the British West Indies, and Hammond was taken aback by the degree of heat Hamilton showed. At a meeting with Jay and Federalist senators, and in a follow-up memo prepared for Washington, Hamilton sketched out Jay's instructions as envoy, making him the primary architect of the treaty that was to result. In addition to compensation, Hamilton wanted a settlement of outstanding issues from the 1783 peace treaty. The most controversial item on his agenda, however, was the forging of a new commercial alliance in which each nation would receive most favored nation status from the other. That is, the lowest possible duties on goods they traded with each other. Presumably, this would increase the volume of trade between the two countries. After some modification, Hamilton's instructions were adopted by the cabinet as Jay's marching orders. In frequent meetings with Jay before his departure, Hamilton made clear that he did not want to coddle the British. On the contrary, because of the outrage voiced by the American people, Hamilton wanted Jay to be tough and demand substantial indemnification. At the same time, he wanted Jay to woo the British with a compelling vision of the advantages of closer Anglo-American ties. On May 12th, 1,000 New Yorkers cheered from the docks as Jay sailed to England, hoping to avert war. Notwithstanding Republican fears, Washington and Hamilton treaded the fine line of neutrality that summer. The U.S. government protested renewed attempts by French privateers to seek asylum in American ports while building up American military strength in case of war with Britain. Washington gave orders to construct 6 frigates, the birth of the U.S. Navy, and Hamilton negotiated contracts for many naval components: cannons, shot and shells, iron ballast, sailcloth, live oak and cedar, and saltpeter for gunpowder. Republicans watched Jay's mission with grave doubts. Madison had a nagging intuition that Jay would surrender too much to England and rupture Franco-American relations. The Republican press clung to the malicious fantasy that Jay would negotiate the sale of America back to the British monarchy. There were fresh rumors to boot that Hamilton was involved in a nefarious plot to make the Duke of Kent, the fourth son of King George III, the new King of the United States. This prompted one Republican wag to opine that the royal family should adopt Alexander Hamilton to sire a new line in America. With Hamilton's well-known attraction to the ladies, the British monarchy would need never worry about a shortage of heirs in America. Even as the repression in France acquired a terrible new ferocity, Republicans could not shed their warm, fraternal attachment to the French Revolution. However upset by gory deeds committed in the name of liberty, Madison was heartened when Joseph Fauché, Citizen Genet's successor as French minister, declared the revolution firm as a rock. Jefferson still gazed at France through rose-colored glasses that magically transformed horrific events into a fresco of glowing colors. "I am convinced they will triumph completely," he said in May 1794, and blamed the excesses not on the French, but on invading tyrants who had dared to embroil them in such wickedness. Far from being repelled by bloodshed, Jefferson awaited the day when kings, nobles, and priests would be packed off to scaffolds which they have been so long deluging with blood. By early summer 1794, that blood ran in rivers, and executions in Paris reached a monstrous toll of nearly 800 per month. Nevertheless, when Jefferson's protege, James Monroe, arrived in France, he embraced the president of the National Assembly and, to Jay's dismay, lauded the heroic valor of French troops. Where Jefferson dismissed these wholesale killings as regrettable but necessary sacrifices to freedom, Hamilton was traumatized by them. The burgeoning atheism of the French Revolution reawakened in him religious feelings that had lain dormant since King's College days. "The very existence of a deity has been questioned and in some instances denied," he wrote in alarm about French attacks on Christianity. "The duty of piety has been ridiculed, the perishable nature of man asserted, and his hopes bounded to the short span of his earthly state. Death has been proclaimed an eternal sleep." For Hamilton, the French Revolution had become a compendium of heretical doctrines, including the notion that morality could exist without religion, or that human nature could be so refined by revolution that government itself will become useless and society will subsist and flourish free from its shackles. Hamilton somehow managed to be worldly without having seen the world. He kept abreast of occurrences in France by subscribing to French newspapers and periodicals, and he polished his French through a Philadelphia tutor, Monsieur Donat. Equally important, he obtained eyewitness accounts of the French Revolution from the exodus of largely aristocratic refugees who flocked to America. At its peak, this refugee flood was so huge that one in every 10 Philadelphians was French. One exile christened the capital the French Noah's Ark. Hamilton felt at home among these elegant, reform-minded aristocrats. Mr. Hamilton spoke French fluently and, as we did not sympathize with the revolutionists who drove the exiles from their homes, he was a favorite with many of the cultivated émigrés, Eliza recalled. He was small, with an extremely composed bearing, unusually small eyes, and something a little furtive in his glance, Moreau de Saint-Marie said of Hamilton. He spoke French, but quite incorrectly. He had a great deal of ready wit, kept a close watch over himself, and was extremely brave. Nobody else ever faulted Hamilton's French. Another émigré, Madame de la Tour du Pin, said of Hamilton, "Although he had never been in Europe, he spoke our language like a Frenchman." Many French aristocrats were directed to Hamilton by Angelica Church, who had entertained them at her bountiful London table. She steered to him the Vicomte de Noailles, Lafayette's brother-in-law, who had formed part of the Brotherhood at Yorktown and knew Hamilton well. Like other refugees, de Noailles had been hopeful at the inception of the French Revolution, then recoiled in horror as it veered toward violence. Church also referred the Duc de La Rochefoucauld Liancourt to Hamilton. An enlightened aristocrat and social reformer who had set up a model farm and two factories, the melancholy Duke had tried to protect the king from mobs in 1792 before seeking safety in England. In Philadelphia, he grew to adore Hamilton. "Mr. Hamilton is one of the finest men in America, at least of those I have seen," he later wrote. "He has breadth of mind and even genuine clearness in his ideas, facility in their expression, information on all points, cheerfulness, excellence of character, and much amiability." Whatever is carping about the French, Hamilton invariably managed to charm them. Most French refugees were in desperate straits, having suffered steep declines in status and wealth. Once well-to-do Frenchmen now scraped out livings by giving French lessons, becoming cooks, or opening small stores. "I wish I was a Croesus," Hamilton told Angelica Church. "I might then afford solid consolations to these children of adversity, and how delightful it would be to do so. But now, sympathy, kind words, and occasionally a dinner are all I can contribute." Both Alexander and Eliza Hamilton had a special feeling for the dispossessed and helped to raise money for indigent French emigres. Beginning in 1793, Hamilton, touched as usual by the plight of distressed women, kept lists of French mothers marooned with their children in America. On one list, he wrote, "One Madame Legrand with two children lives near the little market at the house of Mr. Peter, French hatter in the greatest indigence. 2. Madame Gavin, 2nd Street, North, number 83, with three children, equally destitute." On the attached donor list, the biggest contributor stood out plainly. Eliza Hamilton, $20. Eliza sent off bundles of food and clothing to refugee families, showing an activism that previewed her later dedication to the cause of widows and orphans in New York City. Of all the French expatriates stranded in Philadelphia, none cut a more memorable figure than a French diplomat of unflappable composure who walked with a club foot from a childhood fall and who dissected the world with a sardonic eye. Charles Maurice de Talleyrand-Périgord, better known as Talleyrand. On the eve of the Revolution, the king had named him Bishop of Autun, a reward for managing church finances, not for superior spirituality, but he did not allow the appointment to slow down his dissolute life. Governor Morris described Talleyrand as sly, cool, cunning, and ambitious. He had an acerbic wit, and given his legions of enemies, he needed it. Mirabeau, the French revolutionary politician, once observed of Talleyrand that he would sell his soul for money, and he would be right, for he would be exchanging dung for gold. Napoleon expressed this sentiment more concisely, calling Talleyrand a pile of shit in a silk stocking. A man for all political seasons, Talleyrand had initially hoped the French Revolution would create a dynamic new state based on law, order, and sound finance. He stuck with the Revolution until September 1792, when the overthrow of Louis XVI and the attendant massacres eliminated his last hopes. He sat out the subsequent terror in England and was condemned in absentia for conspiring with the king. British conservatives snubbed him, but he was welcomed by the opposition Whigs, led by Charles James Fox, and by the playwright Richard Brinsley Sheridan, the same social circle inhabited by John and Angelica Church. In January 1794, Talleyrand, informed that he had 5 days to leave England or face deportation, decided to join other stateless émigrés in Philadelphia. The churches subsidized the trip, and Angelica smoothed the way for Talleyrand and his traveling companion, the Chevalier de Beaumetz, by writing to Eliza and introducing the two gentlemen as martyrs for the cause of moderate liberty. "To your care, dear Eliza, I commit these interesting strangers. They are a loan I make to you till I return to America, not to reclaim my friends entirely, but to share their society with you and dear Alexander the Amiable." Angelica regretted that Eliza did not speak French nor Talleyrand English. Talleyrand's linguistic isolation in America made Hamilton's fluency an advantage. After Talleyrand arrived in April, Hamilton sounded out Washington discreetly about receiving him. Talleyrand himself ruled out an unofficial meeting. "If I cannot enter the front door," he declared, "I will not go in the back." Talleyrand was still a pariah in revolutionary France, and Joseph Fauché warned his Parisian superiors of an infernal plan being hatched by Talleyrand and Beaumetz, with Hamilton acting as their confederate. Fauché let Washington know that France frowned upon his receiving Talleyrand, and the president declined a meeting, lest it cause a stir among his Republican detractors. "My wish is to avoid offense to powers with whom we are in friendship by conduct towards their proscribed citizens, which would be disagreeable to them," Washington told Hamilton, suggesting that private citizens take up the social burden of greeting Talleyrand. Talleyrand soon acquired a mulatto mistress, whom he squired openly through the Philadelphia streets. This bothered some priggish souls in polite society, but not Hamilton, although Eliza may have been less forgiving. He was notoriously misshapen, lame in one foot, his manners far from elegant, the tone of his voice was disagreeable, and in dress he was slovenly, she remembered as an old woman. Mr. Hamilton saw much of him, and while he admired the shrewd diplomat for his great intellectual endowments, he detested his utter lack of principle. He had no conscience. Since Fouché was already convinced that Hamilton was in league with Talleyrand, Hamilton suffered no political penalties in meeting with him. He and Talleyrand became companions with a mutual fascination, if not close friends. During his 2 years' sojourn in America, Talleyrand cherished his time with Hamilton and left some remarkable tributes for posterity. "I consider Napoleon, Fox, and Hamilton the three greatest men of our epoch, and if I were forced to decide between the three, I would give without hesitation the first place to Hamilton. He divined Europe." Of Hamilton, he told one American travel writer that he had known nearly all the marked men of his time, but that he had never known one on the whole equal to him. Hamilton savored the roguish diplomat's company and gave him, as a token of esteem, an oval miniature portrait of himself. Hamilton and Talleyrand were both hard-headed men, disgusted with the utopian dreams of their more fanciful, radical compatriots. As one Talleyrand biographer put it, "They were both passionately interested in politics, and both of them looked at politics from a realistic standpoint, and despised sentimental twaddle whether it poured from the lips of a Robespierre or of a Jefferson." Both men wanted to create strong nation-states led by powerful executive branches, and both wanted to counter an aversion to central banks and stock markets. Oddly, Talleyrand agreed with Hamilton that Britain, not France, could best supply America with the long-term credit and industrial products it needed. Talleyrand recalled vividly how Hamilton asserted a passionate faith in America's economic destiny. In their talks, Hamilton said that he foresaw the day when, and it is perhaps not very remote, great markets, such as formerly existed in the old world, will be established in America. Talleyrand confessed to only one complaint about Hamilton, that he was overly enamored of the grand personages of the day and took too little notice of Eliza's beauty. Talleyrand was grateful to Angelica Church for having opened the door to the Hamilton home, and he informed her of Eliza's kindness and Hamilton's unique mind and manners. This elicited from her a remarkable letter to Eliza about the man that had so long mesmerized them both. Angelica Church came close to an outright admission that she was more than just entranced by Hamilton. Socially ambitious, she had always dreamed of political glory for her brother-in-law and now gave full-throated expression to her adoration of him and her hopes for his future. "I have a letter, my dear Eliza, from my worthy friend Monsieur de Talleyrand, who expresses to me his gratitude for an introduction to you and my amiable. By my amiable, you know that I mean your husband, for I love him very much, and if you were as generous as the old Romans, you would lend him to me for a little while. But do not be jealous, my dear Eliza, since I am more solicitous to promote his laudable ambition than any person in the world, and there is no summit of true glory which I do not desire he may attain, provided always that he pleases to give me a little chit-chat and sometimes to say, 'I wish our dear Angelica was here.' Ah, Bess, you were a lucky girl to get so clever and so good a companion." Chapter 26. The Wicked Insurgents of the West. After being exculpated by the House Investigating Committee in late May 1794, Hamilton had informed George Washington that he would not resign after all, citing the prospect of war. In the end, he did go to war, not against European powers, but against American frontier settlers. The Whiskey Rebellion in western Pennsylvania that year was an armed protest against the excise tax on domestic distilled spirits, the whiskey tax, in common lingo, that Hamilton had enacted as part of his funding system. It may qualify as the first sin tax in American history, for in Federalist No. 12, Hamilton had written reprovingly of liquor, "There is perhaps nothing so much a subject of national extravagance as these spirits." The whiskey tax was doomed to be unpopular, inevitably reminding Americans of the Stamp Act and the whole hated apparatus of British tax collecting. Nonetheless, the tax constituted the second largest source of federal revenues and was indispensable to Hamilton. If deprived of that crucial tax, he would have to raise tariffs, which would encourage more smuggling and tax evasion and spur commercial retaliation abroad. The government also needed money to finance military expeditions against the Indians, expeditions that were especially popular in the affected frontier communities, such as those of western Pennsylvania. Shortly after the whiskey tax was passed, federal collectors were shunned, tarred, feathered, blindfolded, and whipped. In May 1792, Hamilton had tried to pacify opponents by lowering the rates, but this conciliatory action did not appease them. That summer, Philip Freneau printed inflammatory letters that likened Hamilton's taxes to those imposed arbitrarily under British rule. The government of the United States, in all things wishing to imitate the corrupt principles of the Court of Great Britain, has commenced the disgraceful career by an excise law. In August 1792, embodying Hamilton's worst nightmare of mob rule, protesters terrorized Captain William Faulkner, who had rented his house to a whiskey tax inspector, Colonel John Neville. Hamilton received hair-raising reports of the incident. They drew a knife on him, threatened to scalp him, tar and feather him, and finally to reduce his house and property to ashes if he did not solemnly promise them to prevent the Office of Inspection from being there. The next day, 30 armed men on horseback, their faces blackened, burst into Faulkner's house, hoping to seize and throttle Neville. Around this time, a mass meeting in Pittsburgh tried to lend a patina of legitimacy to this open lawlessness. The gathering's clerk was a Swiss-born member of the Pennsylvania Assembly, Albert Gallatin, who had taught French at Harvard and spoke with an unmistakable Gaelic accent. A tall, skinny man with a narrow face and hooked nose, Gallatin was a notoriously slovenly character. It was probably Gallatin who drafted a resolution saying the protesters would persist in every legal measure that may obstruct the operation of the excise law until we are able to obtain its total repeal. In the meantime, tax collectors would be treated with the contempt they deserve. Gallatin later portrayed his part in this meeting as my only political sin, but Hamilton had a long memory for such transgressions. Moreover, as we have seen, when sworn in as a U.S. senator in late 1793, Gallatin had quickly emerged as an unremitting Hamilton critic. Refusing to tolerate illegal behavior and not finding the violent protests as colorful as did some later commentators, Hamilton appealed to Washington for vigorous and decisive measures, or else the spirit of disobedience will naturally extend and the authority of the government will be prostrate. Hamilton was being typically decisive. He worried that federal authority was still suspect in the backcountry and needed to be firmly established, ideally by consent, if necessary by force. He wanted Washington to issue a proclamation warning tax evaders to desist, and if they refused, to send in troops. Washington reacted in a more temperate fashion. He issued a call for obedience to the law, but he regarded using soldiers as a last resort and hesitated to deploy troops against domestic opponents. If he dispatched troops, he told Hamilton, critics would only exclaim, "The cat is let out. We now see for what purpose an army was raised." It was an accurate prediction. The mostly Scotch-Irish frontiersmen of western Pennsylvania, who regarded liquor as a beloved refreshment, had the highest per capita concentration of homemade stills in America. In places, whiskey was so ubiquitous that it doubled as money. The rough-hewn backwoods farmers grew abundant wheat that they couldn't transport over the Allegheny Mountains, which were crossed only by narrow horse paths. They solved the problem by distilling the grain into whiskey, pouring it into kegs, and toting them on horseback across the mountains to eastern markets. Some whiskey was also shipped down the Mississippi. Local farmers believed they unfairly bore the economic brunt of Hamilton's excise tax and also resented any interference with their recreational consumption of homemade brew. Trouble flared anew in western Pennsylvania during the summer of 1794, just as Hamilton was bedeviled by family problems. His fifth child, John Church Hamilton, who was almost two, became gravely ill, upsetting the again pregnant Eliza. Although Hamilton scarcely ever took a vacation, he beseeched Washington for permission to make an excursion into the country for a few days to try the effect of exercise and change of air upon the child. When Eliza and beloved Johnny failed to improve after a week, Hamilton extended his leave and escorted them partway to the Schuyler Mansion in Albany. The diligent Hamilton apologized to Washington, saying he hoped that when the delicate state of Mrs. Hamilton's health is taken in connection with that of the child, I trust they will afford a justification of the procrastination. After Mariah Reynolds, the guilt-ridden Hamilton continued to be a doting paterfamilias. While Hamilton nursed his family, whiskey protesters blasted the stills of their neighbors who had honored the tax. They again terrorized Colonel John Neville, the long-suffering whiskey inspector. A Revolutionary War veteran who had served writs on those evading the tax, Neville issued an emergency summons for militia assistance after angry farmers surrounded his house. About a dozen soldiers tried to hold at bay 500 rebels who fired at Neville's house for an hour while torching his crops, barn, stables, and fences. They also kidnapped David Lennox, the U.S. Marshal for the district, who was released after swearing that he would serve no more papers on tax evaders. Lennox and Neville finally fled the region by a circuitous route to avoid personal injury, perhaps assassination, Hamilton told Washington. On August 1st, 6,000 rebels converged on Braddock's Field outside Pittsburgh as extemporaneous violence took on a more systematic character. An organizer named Bradford, having feasted on news of the French Revolution in the Pittsburgh Gazette, touted Robespierre as a splendid model for the crowd. He urged creation of a committee of public safety along Jacobin lines, and several weeks later exhorted his comrades to erect guillotines. To obtain weapons, the rebels decided to attack the government garrison at Pittsburgh, with Bradford boasting, "We will defeat the first army that comes over the mountains and take their arms and baggage." Always haunted by the hobgoblins of disorder, Hamilton saw more than mass disobedience. He saw signs of treasonous plots against the government. The man who seldom wavered sent Washington a 7,500-word account, reviewing the thuggish punishments meted out to revenue officers since the excise tax was introduced. Hamilton wished to strip these violations of any veneer of acceptable civil disobedience, and showed they had been massive, vicious, and premeditated. He was not alone in perceiving a more general threat. Attorney General William Bradford regarded the Western upheaval as a formed and regular plan for weakening and perhaps overthrowing the general government, while Secretary of War Knox wanted to combat the unrest with a superabundant force. Regarding the uprising as a direct threat to constitutional order, Washington asked Supreme Court Justice James Wilson to declare a state of anarchy around Pittsburgh. When it came to law enforcement, Hamilton believed that an overwhelming show of force often obviated the need to employ it. Whenever the government appears in arms, it ought to appear like a Hercules and inspire respect by the display of strength. The consideration of expense is of no moment compared with the advantages of energy. Meeting with state officials on a blazing day in early August, Hamilton advised them to send troops to the western part of the state. He recommended that Washington assemble a multi-state militia of 12,000 men to suppress an uprising estimated at 7,000 armed men. Secretary of State Edmund Randolph advised against sending troops, fearing it would only unify the protesters, and called instead for a spirit of reconciliation, a position echoed by Pennsylvania officials. Washington contrived a statesmanlike compromise between Hamilton's truculence and Randolph's civility. He issued a proclamation telling the insurgents to desist by September 1st, or the government would send in a militia. At the same time, he announced that a three-man commission would confer with citizens. William Bradford was picked as one of the three commissioners, and before the Attorney General headed west, Hamilton, later accused of lusting for a showdown with the rioters, told him that he was prepared to enact any reasonable alterations to make the excise tax more palatable. For in truth, he told Bradford, every admissible accommodation in this way would accord with the wishes of this department. This lenient approach, unfortunately, only emboldened the rebels. On August 17th, the three commissioners met with concerned Pittsburgh residents who contended that extremists, both numerous and violent, had resolved to resist the excise tax at all hazards. The commissioners reluctantly concluded that enforcing compliance with the law would require the physical strength of the nation. As the use of force loomed, Knox told Washington that he had to go to Maine to deal with some pressing real estate problems, though he said he could postpone the trip if necessary. Remarkably enough, Washington let Knox go at this critical moment, which meant that temporary responsibility for the War Department fell upon Hamilton's slim shoulders. This once more provided emphatic proof of Washington's faith in Hamilton's varied abilities and of Hamilton's perennial eagerness to exercise power. Hamilton found himself in an agonizing predicament. He was immersed in urgent business. "I have scarcely a moment to spare," he had told Eliza, as he assigned contracts to military vendors for a possible operation in western Pennsylvania. He was ordering horses, tents, and other military stores, and did not feel he could vacate his post. But the news he received from Eliza in Albany made him heartsick. Little Johnny, despite treatment with laudanum and lime water, was losing ground, and Eliza's pregnancy was precarious. As he tore open each letter, Hamilton trembled that it might announce his son's death. "Alas, my charmer, great are my fears, poignant my distress," he told Eliza. "I feel every day more and more how dear this child is to me, and I cease not to pray heaven for his recovery." Hamilton's letters show both love for his family and an encyclopedic medical knowledge. He gave Eliza minute instructions on what to do if the baby's situation worsened. "If he is worse, abandon the laudanum and try the cold bath. That is, abandon the laudanum by degrees, giving it overnight but not in the morning, and then leaving it off altogether. Let the water be put in the kitchen overnight, and in the morning let the child be dipped in it head foremost, wrapping up his head well and taking him again immediately out, put in flannel and rubbed dry with towels. Immediately upon his being taken out, let him have 2 teaspoonsful of brandy, mixed with just enough water to prevent its taking away his breath. Observe well his lips. If a glow succeeds, continue the bath. If a chill takes place, forbear it." This sounds like more than book knowledge. Somewhere along the way, possibly as a boy or in the army, he had learned a considerable amount about nursing the sick and did so with a touching solicitude. By the end of the month, John Church Hamilton had started to recover, and Hamilton sent his wife and child to New York City, where they remained under the watchful care of Nicholas Fish and Elisha Boudinot. All the while, events in western Pennsylvania lurched toward an open confrontation with the government. On the morning of August 23, 1794, subscribers to the American Daily Advertiser of Philadelphia read an impassioned warning from a writer called Tully. For this apprehensive author, the tumult in western Pennsylvania was a thinly veiled pretext for tearing down the constitutional order. The foes of the federal government were too cunning to attack it directly, he argued, so they feigned moderation and exploited issues such as the excise tax. Despite ailing health, Hamilton wrote 3 more Tully letters during the next 9 days. As always, his easily alarmed mind dwelled on dire outcomes. "There is no road to despotism more sure or more to be dreaded than that which begins at anarchy." In Hamilton's opinion, the most sacred duty of government was an inviolable respect for the Constitution and laws. He believed the supreme test of the new government's strength was at hand. Scarcely had Tully spoken than the 3 commissioners returned from western Pennsylvania and offered Washington's cabinet a bleak assessment. During a marathon 8-hour session, Washington, Hamilton, and Randolph decided to call up Virginia's militia under Governor Henry Lee and muster an additional force of up to 15,000 troops for possible action. After the meeting, Hamilton swung into action to line up additional supplies. Like Hamilton, Washington feared that a disruptive faction wanted to pull down the government, and he was prepared to defend the Constitution at all costs. Still, with his finely honed instincts, he delayed dispatching troops. The more assertive Hamilton gave Washington evidence of militia colonels who had abetted the rioters and of judges who had defended resistance to the tax. There had not been a single instance, he alleged, where a Pennsylvania official had punished someone for flouting the whiskey tax. Especially upsetting was the fear that the upheaval might be spreading to other states. When Maryland summoned its militia to enforce the tax, soldiers turned on their officers and set up a liberty pole in the courthouse square. Rumor claimed that the rebels were about to pillage the state armory for weapons. By September 9th, Washington had had enough. If the laws are to be trampled upon with impunity, he said, and a minority is to dictate to the majority, there is an end put at one stroke to Republican government. Worried about the advent of cold weather, he ordered troops to march to western Pennsylvania. Since Pennsylvania had been reluctant to quash the insurrection, militia from New Jersey, Maryland, and Virginia were recruited instead. Hamilton was in constant motion as he bore the burdens of both the Treasury and War Departments. With his inexhaustible capacity for work, he outfitted an entire army, ordering shoes, blankets, shirts, coats, medicine chests, kettles, rifles, and muskets. As was his wont, he specified everything in great detail, especially when it came to uniforms. The jackets ought to be made of some of the stuffs of which sailors' jackets are usually made, he ordered, and like them, without skirts, but of sufficient length of body to protect well the bowels. The trousers, or rather overalls, ought also to be of some strong, coarse, cheap woolen stuff. Though the natural leader of the Western expedition, Washington wanted to limit his participation. The president will be governed by circumstances, Hamilton told Rufus King. If the thing puts on an appearance of magnitude, he goes. If not, he stays. Hamilton himself had never outgrown his love of martial glory and yearned to participate. If permitted, I shall at any rate go. As author of the excise tax, Hamilton assured Washington, it would be good for him to accompany the army. In a government like ours, it cannot but have a good effect for the person who is understood to be the advisor or proposer of a measure, which involves danger to his fellow citizens, to partake in that danger. Washington acceded to Hamilton's wishes. Secretary of State Randolph then felt obliged to remind Washington how much Colonel Hamilton's accompanying him was talked of out of doors, and how much stress was laid upon the seeming necessity of the commander-in-chief having him always at his elbow. Hamilton remained in a state of trepidation about Eliza's pregnancy. The day before departing for western Pennsylvania, he tried to reassure his children with breezy words. For by the accounts we have received here, there will be no fighting and, of course, no danger. It will only be an agreeable ride, which I hope will do me good. On the morning of September 30th, Washington and Hamilton set off, quaintly, for war. They climbed into a carriage on Market Street and headed west to join the troops. Soon they rolled through peaceful farmland. If this carriage ride seems less than epic in nature, we must recall that Washington, 62, could no longer endure long days in the saddle. Hamilton made the travel arrangements for the president and scrupulously declared that if the president stayed in any private homes, he would insist upon paying. Otherwise, he would take rooms at local taverns. With Hamilton tending to Washington's needs, the general and his former aide-de-camp must have experienced a queer sense of déjà vu. Hamilton was back, serving his general. On the other hand, Hamilton, 39, had become a mighty figure in his own right. It was far less remarkable that Washington had been elevated to the presidency than that his former aide had risen to become America's second most powerful man. By October 4th, the two men reached their rendezvous with troops at Carlisle, Pennsylvania, in the state's southern tier, about halfway to Pittsburgh. They reviewed a throng of 3,000 soldiers, an army that finally swelled to 12,000 men. The super-efficient Hamilton bristled when he discovered that shipments of clothing and ammunition had not arrived and gave a tongue-lashing to the person responsible. For heaven's sake, send forward a man that can be depended upon on each route to hasten them. My expectations have been egregiously disappointed. While Washington and Hamilton camped at Carlisle, emissaries from western Pennsylvania, led by Congressman William Findlay, a former weaver, tried to persuade them to turn back. They reported that people in the West Country would now submit to the excise tax without coercion. Washington replied that if no shots were fired at his troops, no force would be used, but that he would not desist. Hamilton was even more unyielding. When Findlay mentioned one individual who was supposedly restoring order in the area, Hamilton answered us that that very man, if he was met with, would be skewered, shot, or hanged on the first tree. Seeing the expedition as a major test of government will, Hamilton was in no mood to back down. While the army was at Carlisle, a young man named David Chambers brought messages from Governor Henry Lee. He later left this telling vignette of Hamilton and Washington. As soon as it was known that dispatches had arrived from General Lee, they were taken possession of and earnestly perused by Colonel Hamilton, who seemed to be the master spirit. The president remained aloof, conversing with the writer in relation to roads, distances, etc. Washington was grave, distant, and austere. Hamilton was kind, courteous, and frank. Hamilton in person prepared answers to the dispatches and, with the most insinuating and easy familiarity, encouraged the writer to carry out the purpose of the mission with dispatch and fidelity. At the same time, he bestowed a douceur from his purse. Later, crossing the Alleghenies, Chambers again encountered Hamilton, who gave him a tour of the troops with all the familiarity and kindness of a father. Hamilton always found bracing the manly atmosphere of a military camp. Setting up an elegant tent for himself, he strode about and swapped stories of the Revolution with soldiers. Never a martinet, Hamilton did insist on discipline and condoned no lapses. Often he roamed the camp after dark, surprising sentries at their posts. Finding one wealthy young sentry seated lazily with his musket by his side, Hamilton reproached his laxity. After the youth complained of a soldier's hard life, Hamilton shouldered the musket and, pacing to and fro, remained on guard until relieved, John Church Hamilton later wrote. The incident was rumored throughout the camp, nor did the lesson require repetition. Hamilton's experience with this amateurish militia reinforced his long-held conviction that the central government needed a standing army. In the expedition against the Western insurgents, he later said, I trembled every moment lest a great part of the militia should take it into their heads to return home rather than go forward. A larger federal army was exactly what Republicans feared, and Madison reported to Jefferson that fashionable language was now being heard in Philadelphia that a standing army might soon be necessary for enforcing the laws. Washington decided that, if the army's situation looked favorable, his own involvement would terminate at Carlisle. So, at the end of October, he returned to Philadelphia and left Hamilton and Virginia Governor Henry Lee in charge of an army larger than the one he had usually headed in the Revolution. The soldiers marched west along muddy roads in soaking rains. Despite these conditions, Hamilton's health was restored by the campaign, and he even wrote playfully to Angelica Church about his exploits. In a letter marked 205 miles westward of Philadelphia, he told his sister-in-law, I am thus far, my dear Angelica, on my way to attack and subdue the wicked insurgents of the West. But you are not to promise that I shall have any trophies to lay at your feet. A large army has cooled the courage of those madmen, and the only question seems now to be how to guard best against the return of the frenzy. Once Washington left Hamilton in charge of one wing of the army, the imagination of the Republican press ran riot. The Whiskey Rebellion conjured up their favorite boogeyman of Hamilton as the man on horseback, the military despot in waiting. Now that Freneau's paper had folded, the principal source of anti-Hamilton bile was Benjamin Franklin Bache, a grandson of Benjamin Franklin and editor of a newspaper soon known as the Aurora. As Hamilton rode the soggy, rutted roads of western Pennsylvania, Bache saw devilry in his leadership. By some, it is whispered that he is with the army without invitation, and by many, it is shrewdly suspected his conduct is a first step towards a deep-laid scheme, not for the promotion of the country's prosperity, but the advancement of his private interests. Washington, unfazed, sent this screed to Hamilton, who replied that it is long since I have learnt to hold popular opinion of no value. The military expedition met little overt resistance in the mutinous regions. Many delinquent distillers were rounded up, and others either surrendered or fled into the mountains. At times, the behavior of the rowdy, heavy-drinking soldiers was more worrisome than that of the whiskey rebels, and at least two innocent civilians were killed by militia. Washington set an important precedent by having these soldiers tried in civilian, not military, courts. Hamilton was appalled by his meetings with disaffected elements, which convinced him that revolutionary tendencies had to be extirpated root and branch. He wanted the culprits to lose their homes or even be deported, the beginning of a major shift in his tolerant views on immigration. This business must not be skinned over, he told Rufus King. The political putrefaction of Pennsylvania is greater than I had any idea of. He was especially disturbed by the involvement of elected officials in the uprising. Federal action in suppressing the Whiskey Rebellion left behind a trail of controversy. William Findlay believed that Hamilton had welcomed this chance to prove the government's power. He left a one-sided chronicle of events that gives a glimpse of Hamilton's tough prosecutorial tactics in interrogating prisoners. Hamilton was especially harsh toward those he deemed the leaders. In one case, he questioned a major Powers about Albert Gallatin's role at insurgent rallies. When Powers answered grudgingly, Hamilton advised him to take an hour to refresh his memory. Findlay claims that Powers was flung into a room with other prisoners with a bayonet at his head. An hour later, with Hamilton suddenly assuming all his terrors, he told Major Powers that he was surprised at him, that having the character of an honest man, he would not tell the truth, asserting that he had already proofs sufficient of the truth of what he knew he could testify. Powers was held in military custody for 8 days, then released as innocent of all charges. Another suspect, Hugh Henry Brackenridge, was questioned by Hamilton, who struck him as courteous if severe. He was willing to treat me with civility, but was embarrassed with a sense that in a short time I must probably stand in the predicament of a culprit and be in irons. Hamilton asked Breckinridge bluntly if he had planned to overthrow the government, at which point the prisoner recounted his actions. Hamilton scribbled detailed notes during this 2-day interrogation, then freed Breckinridge, saying he had been misrepresented. Hamilton's behavior here would seem exemplary. The Treasury Secretary had taken 2 days to weigh a man's innocence, but William Findlay talked only of the terrors that Hamilton had dispensed to Breckinridge. Breckinridge himself believed that the show of force orchestrated by the federal government had made its use unnecessary, just as Hamilton had predicted. Findlay told of his own interrogation at the hands of Hamilton, who believed that Findlay had published 13 anonymous newspaper pieces against him. According to Findlay, Hamilton snapped at him that he would never forgive me because I had told or wrote lies about him. Hamilton was irate that Findlay and Gallatin, both elected representatives, had abetted the troublemakers. He expressed much surprise and indignation at their reposing so much confidence in foreigners, that Gallatin and I were both foreigners and therefore not to be trusted. Findlay, who had been born in Ireland, found it scandalous that Hamilton, of all people, should object to his immigrant background. I say for Secretary Hamilton to object to such a man as a foreigner must be astonishing to those who have any knowledge of his own history. Public opinion applauded the way Washington balanced firmness and clemency in suppressing the Whiskey Rebellion. There had been very few deaths. Washington and Hamilton had brought new prestige to the government and shown how a democratic society could handle popular disorder without resort to despotic methods. Contrary to European wisdom, democracies did not necessarily degenerate into lawlessness. Hamilton wanted to make an example of some perpetrators, but Henry Lee issued an amnesty proclamation that exempted from prosecution all but about 150 prisoners alleged to have committed atrocities. Although 2 insurrectionists were accused of treason and convicted, Washington, with his usual magnanimity, pardoned them. Hamilton feared that this clemency would only encourage lawless elements. In a public postmortem on the rebellion, Washington blamed the democratic republican societies that had sprouted in the wake of Citizen Genet's arrival. This presidential message to Congress infuriated James Madison, who rated it perhaps the greatest error of Washington's political career and further proof that he was the tool of Alexander Hamilton. The game was to connect the democratic societies with the odium of resurrection, to connect the Republicans in Congress with those societies, and to put the president ostensibly at the head of the other party in opposition to both, Madison fumed. He saw the Whiskey Rebellion as the prelude to the establishment of a standing army that would constrain American liberties. Like Madison, Jefferson regarded the uprising as another instance of Hamilton's vainglorious desire to exercise power and of his fiendish control over Washington's mind. Jefferson had never liked the infernal excise tax and had the temerity to label the episode Hamilton's insurrection. Jefferson likened Washington to an aging captain in his cabin who dozed while a rogue of a pilot has run them into an enemy's port. Hamilton's friend Timothy Pickering later observed that the excise tax remained particularly odious to the whiskey drinkers, and that Jefferson's pledge to repeal the tax did much to boost his popularity. So it may be said with undoubted truth that the whiskey drinkers made Mr. Jefferson the President of the United States. Enough rancor toward Hamilton remained in western Pennsylvania that he required a special escort of 6 soldiers on horseback when he left Pittsburgh in late November. Tired and weather-beaten from almost 2 months on the road, he galloped toward Philadelphia with an urgent need to see Eliza, who still struggled with a difficult pregnancy and felt alone without him. Even Angelica Church in London knew about the strained situation. "During his absence, I know, my love, that you have been very unhappy, and I have often thought of you with more than common tenderness," she wrote to Eliza. On November 24th, Henry Knox told Hamilton of Eliza's earnest prayers for his return. "It seems that she has had or has been in danger of a miscarriage, which has much alarmed her." The guardian angel of the Hamilton household, Edward Stevens, who seemed to appear at providential moments, now tended Eliza and reassured her that she was in no danger. Nevertheless, Knox informed Hamilton that she was extremely desirous of your presence, and in order to tranquilize her, this note is transmitted by the president's request. It turned out that Eliza did have a miscarriage, and Hamilton flagellated himself for this misfortune. "My dear Eliza has been lately very ill," he wrote to Angelica Church in early December, sidestepping direct mention of the miscarriage. "Thank God she is now quite recovered, except that she continues somewhat weak. My absence on a certain expedition was the cause. You will see, notwithstanding your disparagement of me, I am still of consequence to her." Ever since the Mariah Reynolds fiasco, Hamilton had tried to be attentive to his family, but the ceaseless demands of public life had often denied him the necessary time, and now his absence had yielded dreadful results. Hamilton now believed that his great opportunities lay behind him. On December 1st, 1794, the day he returned to Philadelphia, he told Washington that he would surrender his treasury post in late January. One wonders whether Eliza's miscarriage affected this snap decision. With her selfless love for Hamilton, she didn't care for the blood sport that passed for politics and was disgusted by the unceasing attacks on her husband. It pained her to see the scant appreciation for his sacrifices. Angelica Church wrote to Eliza with mixed emotions when she heard of Hamilton's rumored resignation. "The country will lose one of her best friends, and you, my dear Eliza, will be the only person to whom this change can be either necessary or agreeable. I am inclined to believe that it is your influence that induces him to withdraw from public life." Church knew Hamilton's fun-loving side and agreed that Hamilton needed a respite from politics, telling Eliza that when you and I are with him, he shall not talk politics to us. A little of his agreeable nonsense will do us more good. The news of Hamilton's departure was a watershed for Washington, who had made him the master builder of the new government. When John Marshall later read through Washington's correspondence for his authorized biography, he expressed astonishment at the proportion of it from Hamilton's pen. In acknowledging Hamilton's resignation, Washington penned one of his loftiest tributes. "In every relation which you have borne to me, I have found that my confidence in your talents, exertions, and integrity has been well placed. I the more freely render this testimony of my approbation, because I speak from opportunities of information which cannot deceive me, and which furnish satisfactory proof of your title to public regard. My most earnest wishes for your happiness will attend you in retirement." The letter shows why Washington tended to discount the Jeffersonian invective against Hamilton. Both as general and president, Washington had numberless chances to observe Hamilton and had seen only competence, dedication, and integrity. In yet another tribute to Hamilton, Washington replaced him with his deputy at Treasury, Oliver Wolcott, Jr. Hamilton was eager to leave office with an unscarred reputation and immediately informed House Speaker Muhlenberg of his planned resignation. He wanted to give the select investigating committee time to pursue any last-minute inquiries so that nobody would ever intimate that he had ducked questions. It was not Hamilton's style to fade away quietly, and he mustered the strength for one last voluminous report on government finance, which he submitted to the House on January 19, 1795. He wanted to chart a wide-ranging course for the future. Washington had recently asked Congress for plans to retire the public debt and prevent that progressive accumulation of debt which must ultimately endanger all government. Congress had debated piecemeal proposals instead of a comprehensive plan. For a long time, Hamilton had chafed at the distorted perception that he invariably viewed a public debt as a public blessing. In many circumstances, he knew, a public debt could be a public curse. "The debt of France brought about her revolution," he wrote. "Financial embarrassments led to those steps which led to the overthrow of the government and to all the terrible scenes which have followed." Despite such disclaimers, Hamilton could not shake the pernicious stereotype that he always favored a large public debt. Jefferson told a friend about the public debt, "The only difference between the two parties is that the Republican one wish it could be paid tomorrow, and the fiscal, Federalist, party wish it to be perpetual, because they find in it an engine for corrupting the legislature." Debt was a legitimate concern, with an astounding 55% of federal expenditures being siphoned off to service it. End of Disc 19.